Ah, the traditional sound of the crowing rooster. Before we start here at Stand to Reason, I'm Jay Warnawalla, sitting in for Greg Kokel again this week, as he is still out on vacation. I think he's in Minnesota, I heard, which is pretty cool. This is a good time of year, I think, to be out in Minnesota. I just was here in Southern California. It's supposed to be hot today, but it's been like overcast, weird kind of hot. Almost like it's like hot in the South kind of hot. A little bit of humidity. Unusual for us. But thanks for joining us here, where we get to answer the most important, talk about the most important things that you can talk about in terms of your Christian worldview. If you want to join us with a question, please call us at 855-243-9975. 855-243-9975. And our international number is 562-424-8229. We have one person in the queue. We got lots of room for you, though, so please call us right now. By the way, did you know that Greg's interview with Focus on the Family is actually available right now? You can go to the Focus on the Family website, and if you go to the episodes section and the broadcast section, you can search for for Focus on the Family on YouTube. You can actually see his interview, and it's called Sharing Your Faith with Grace and Purpose, and he talks about tactics you can use, which of course you're very familiar with, but it's really neat to hear how he describes these in Focus on the Family, because if you've been trying to explain to your Christian brothers and sisters how to how to kind of communicate this, well, we do these kinds of radio shows where we're talking to an audience that maybe is not necessarily already kind of primed, already kind of familiar with apologetics. Well, you really have to kind of figure out, how do I describe this in a way that somebody who's not geeked out on apologetics like I am is able to understand it? And that's what Greg gets a chance to do on the Focus on the Family interview. So check that out at the Focus on the Family website, or just by Googling Focus on the Family on YouTube. Also, did you know that Stand to Reason is now on LinkedIn? So if you're on a LinkedIn and you want to be updated with all the stuff, the content that comes through, I don't know. I actually think that, surprisingly, I'm on all those social media platforms, and I'm amazed at how many people are using LinkedIn for information. So they are now at LinkedIn. Just search for Stand to Reason and click the follow to see the updates. That being said, at the beginning, the top of this hour, I want to talk a little bit about some of the benefits of, you know, why do we even have dedicated ministries where we're trying to make a case for the Christian worldview? Why do we do radio shows? Why do we do television shows? All the video content that is available, for example, at Stand to Reason, I don't know if you even realize that they're producing a new video every week that's on the, I think it's on Monday they release it, and so you get a chance to kind of to explore topics in apologetics, Christian worldview. Why do we do that? Why do we take time to make videos? Why do we take time to do radio shows? Well, a lot of it is about the fact that we know the number one, truth is more, even an inconvenient truth is more important and more transformational than a convenient lie. And we happen to hold the truth. And although you might be thinking, in a culture in which we live today, that the Christian truth is not the kind of truth that makes it easy to live. And, you know, I had a student last week write to me, and here was his claim. He said, you know, the more I study Christianity, the more I study the evidence for the Christian worldview, the more convinced I become that Christianity is true. But now I wonder, the more I know about what it entails, about what God is calling me to, about what God believes or what God proclaims about certain moral behaviors, about certain truth claims in history, about certain truth claims about for me today. His question now was, well, do I want to be a Christian? Like before, he wasn't quite sure the depth and robust nature of what the implications would be to be a Christian, because he had a very cultural sense of what it was to be a Christian. So back then, it was easy to be a Christian because you didn't really it didn't really impact his life the way it feels like it's impacting it now. Like now he understands the gravity of what it means to be a Christ follower. And now he's thinking to himself, do I even want to do this? And I thought to myself as I'm reading this email, how sad is that? And it's true. Like I will often say, and Greg will tell you that when we're at conferences together and I say this the way I say it, he always says, you shouldn't say it that way. But it hasn't stopped me from saying it that way. But I'll always say that I'm not a Christian because it works for me, because it doesn't work for me. Now, in the sense that does it save me? Of course. I mean, that's not what I'm saying when it doesn't work. What I mean is, to live and proclaim your Christian faith in a world right now is not going to have the kinds of practical benefits that some people think it might have. especially for young people. That's what this young man was writing to me in the email. He's saying, now that I know what Christianity entails, this is not going to make for an easy life. This is not going to, it's not going to work to make me more popular, that's for sure. It's not going to work to make me more politically correct or acceptable on social media, that's for sure. That's true. And so now he's wondering if the cost is too high. Isn't that interesting? What I want to share with you in this first part of the hour is from an article that I wrote called Three Good Reasons to Celebrate Your Christian Worldview. And it struck me that as I'm listening to this student talk about how he's not sure there's much, in other words, it's almost too hard to be a consistent believing Christian that expresses what they believe accurately as a Christian. It's easy, by the way, to have a cultural view of Christianity where you're not even sure what Jesus teaches on any significant issue. So, and I can twist and turn what Jesus teaches because I'm not really familiar with what the Bible teaches anyway. But the more I learn and how to exegete scripture, the more I learn what it is Jesus said on particular issues, the less comfortable I feel like I'm becoming. And that was his claim. But let me just give for you three reasons to celebrate your Christian worldview. Here's the first one. It turns out the Christian worldview actually describes the world accurately. I like to say it, that, and Greg says this all the time. That's why he's got a book called The Story of Reality. And by the way, if you haven't gotten a copy of The Story of Reality, what are you waiting for? You've been listening to Greg Kochel for how long and you don't own a copy of The Story of Reality? Look, you can talk about The Story of Reality 1,000 times on this radio show. You will not get the most robust version of what Greg talks about in that book until you buy the book. Now, look, I'm not trying to sell Greg's books. I'm just saying, when I read that book for the first time, I thought, wow, this is C.S. Lewis in 2021. This is well written. It is quick. It is not a fact-filled kind of like a scientifically proclaimed kind of. No, it's not like that. This is a case for Christianity, a case for God's existence. It's very accessible. And it's fun to read. And he talks about this issue, that the Christian worldview describes the world the way it really is. And I knew that after I became a Christian, because a lot of the principles, the things I observed in the life and behavior of the criminals I was taking to jail, well, it turned out they were perfectly described by Scripture 2,000 years before I ever discovered them working cases. Why? Because the Christian Scriptures describe the world the way it really is, not just from the beginning of the universe and the existence of our universe, but even in terms of biblical anthropology, like what is it about human nature? If you're working investigations, if you're working crimes, at some point you're going to see certain things about the world around you, and it turns out those things have already been described before you were ever born in the Christian Scriptures. It turns out the Scriptures describe the world the way they really are, the way it really is. And so what's great about that is if you hold a Christian worldview, you are holding a worldview that has an accurate description of reality. Remember, all worldviews describe three things. How do we get here? Why is it so messed up? And how do we fix it? And every worldview, whether it's a theistic worldview or a non-theistic worldview, describes the same three things. How do we get here? If you're a Marxist, how do we get here? We're the process of, we're the product of some evolutionary process. Why is it so messed up? The inadequate and the unequal distribution of wealth. How do we fix it? Well, we redistribute the wealth. There's lots of ways to answer those three questions. Christianity happens to answer those and describe the world the way it really is, that we are actually designed in the image of a God that accounts for the incredible beauty that we are capable of. And our rebellious nature, which is described in Genesis 1, is evident every day. We are deeply fallen, rebellious creatures. We are not born good and corrupted by a system or corrupted by our culture. We are fallen creatures that will corrupt every system and corrupt every culture if given a chance. And Christianity describes that perfectly. Second thing, the Christian worldview actually holds up to scrutiny. So you could examine it. Look, if I hold a worldview, if I was Baha'i, for example, how would I test the Baha'i faith? How would I test the writings, the sacred writings of Baha'u'llah? They aren't really making claims about history that could be tested. They're making proclamations about deity, proverbial claims about the nature of life. And you could say, well, yeah, that seems like it's like fortune cookie kind of theology. How could you ever examine and scrutinize evidentially. Look, when you hold a worldview that makes a claim about history, well, now that's something we can test. And it turns out that Christianity makes the most stringent claim about a single event that, if not true, falsifies Christianity. If the resurrection didn't occur, Christianity is false. So you might say, well, yeah, I don't think there's good enough evidence for resurrection. Fine. But the point is, it can be scrutinized. It's evidential in its very claims because it claims something in history that you could test. That makes a difference. Not every worldview is like that. Third, the Christian worldview provides a solution that provides hope. Look, if I'm under an atheistic worldview, what is eventually you're going to die. What is the ultimate solution for what ails us? There is no hope beyond the grave. So as you get to be my age and you're looking at, hey, I got more time on the back nine of my golf course, right? So, I mean, seriously? This is not why it's true, because I have this false need or this false hope in a future that's not true, a fairy tale that makes me feel good. But if Christianity is true, it is going to provide you with hope and solve a problem that you cannot solve for yourself. How are we restored? Our problem is a sin problem. Our problem, we were designed in the image of God, but choose to rebel significantly, and because of our sin, we have incurred punishment. And the punishment then is taken by Jesus on the cross, and his resurrection demonstrates for us, number one, that he is God, and number two, that we have hope for our own resurrection. We have hope that is beyond death. So there are some benefits to this. By the way, if you don't think that's a benefit, this article I've written online is called Three Good Reasons to Celebrate the Christian Worldview. But if you were to go on our website and just type in the search engine, Fearing Death, I'll do that now. I've written another article that demonstrates why this is so important, why the idea of having hope beyond the grave is actually, so I'm going to just type that in now. Let's do this here. Fear. Even the word fear should bring it up. It turns out that most people have a fear of death. But why do they have a fear of death? It turns out that this idea of the persistent self, this is what psychologists call the persistent self, that those people who have good evidential reason to believe that their worldview substantiates the idea of the persistent self, a self that extends beyond the grave, fear death less. They live a different kind of life in their later years because they believe that their self-identity persists beyond the grave. And any worldview that gives you this notion of persistent self turns out to be something that is beneficial in other ways. Now, that's not why I believe Christianity is true, because I have this false hope and this kind of poorly substantiated belief. No, actually, in the last hour, you can see it earlier this week in our broadcast, somebody called in and asked the question, you know, is our faith based on blind? Is it all from what God does? Is it based in some aspect of evidence? And it turns out that it is based in an aspect of evidence, which is Jesus says it consistently in the Gospel of John. He demonstrates it by spending 40 days with his disciples and after the resurrection, giving them many convincing proofs. And let me just give it to you one last way as an illustration. Look, a lot of us face challenges, and the Christian worldview ought to give us a different attitude about our challenges. And here's why I say that. I often use this illustration about a bulletproof vest, right? The idea is that when I investigated one of my officer-involved shootings, the officer who was involved in the shooting, he was confronted by a suspect who got the draw on him before he could pull his gun out of his holster. And he knew that he was too late to the draw. He was going to get shot. But he said because he had seen his vest stop bullets in the range where we test the vests and shoot at them, that he decided in that moment just to trust his vest, take a deep breath, tense his stomach muscles, take the first round from the suspect, and then return fire. And he stood calmly in that shooting. He didn't panic. He didn't jump. He didn't do anything like that because he had good evidential reason to believe the vest would stop bullets. If you believe something is true because it can be scrutinized evidentially, it will give you calm and hope in difficult situations. The whole reason why he was able to stand there unflinchingly in that shooting was because he had prior evidential reason to believe the vest would stop the bullets. So it turns out the fact that, you know, these three things we talked about, right, that will actually give you confidence, and some of the benefits of a Christian worldview. This idea that the Christian worldview, number one, that you can be scrutinized evidentially, is a huge benefit, because what it allows us to do is to have evidential confidence. And just like his confidence in the vest allowed him to stand tall and calmly in the face of danger, your evidential confidence in Christianity will allow you to withstand the troubles and all the different trials you're going to face as a Christian, because you had prior evidential certainty. And that's important. That's a definite advantage to the Christian worldview, even when compared to other theistic systems. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll start taking your calls. I want you to call me at 855-243-9975 or internationally at 562-424-8229. We only have one person in the queue. I want to be able to spend the entire hour answering your questions. So please call now and provide a question, and we'll make sure we answer it right here at Stand to Reason.
You can take Stand to Reason with you through our mobile apps, available for free from the App Store or the Google Play Store. The Quick Reference app gives you short, easily accessible courses on our most popular topics like tactics, homosexuality in the Bible, morality, the story of reality, and many more. The Stand to Reason app has all our latest content available at your fingertips. You can listen to our podcasts, check the blog, and access timely and practical resources. They're free, so download the apps today on the App Store or the Google Play Store and start carrying Stand to Reason with you everywhere you go. If you enjoy our apps, you can help other people find them by rating them on the App Store or the Google Play Store.
Hey friends, would you like to be encouraged throughout your week with timely, relevant content meant to bolster your knowledge, wisdom, and character? Or maybe you have a desire to be connected with other like-minded Christians from around the world. If so, then you need to follow Stand to Reason on social media. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Not only will you be able to interact with other Stand to Reason followers, but you'll also stay up to date and informed on our latest resources and events. In our current culture, it's important to have something of value to break up your social media feed. So just visit str.org and find the links to all of our social media platforms at the bottom of the homepage.
All right, Jay Warren Wallace back here at Stand to Reason, sitting in for Greg Kokel, who is out on vacation. Really glad to be here with you and grateful that Greg would trust me with the ship here. By the way, if you are not signed up or not looking at our Reality Student Apologetics Conference website, it's at realityapologetics.com. Realityapologetics.com. Used to be called Rethink Apologetics. Now it's Reality Apologetics. And I think that's great considering that Greg has written the book Reality. So it's important for you to kind of look at our five locations this year for 2021 and 2022. We are all over the place, and some of the places that you might think are maybe not the kind of hotbed of Christian activity, right? We've got one here in Southern California. We've got one in the Seattle, Washington area, one in Minneapolis, and one in Dallas, of course. And I think we got one this year near Atlanta. So we are in great places all over the country. Wherever you are, you can probably make it down to see us. Look at our calendar at realityapologetics.com, and please join us. And by the way, before I take the first call here from Oliver, I wanted to tell you that the website where I have been writing about this idea of the persistent self is a website article at Cold Case Christianity called Afraid to Die? You're Probably Not a Christian. And what I look at there are the different worldviews and how they parse out this idea of the persistent self. So, for example, Buddhism argues against the existence of self altogether. According to Buddhism, your sense of self is only an illusion. And for this reason, it will not extend beyond your mortal existence because it's been illusory the entire time. Hinduism, for example, argues for the reincarnation of self. Now, think about that. While your self may continue into the next life, its reincarnated characteristics and attributes attributes and traits and memories will all be very different. So the idea of a persistent self doesn't really apply to Hinduism either. Under atheism, there's an entirely materialistic version of self. So you know, yourself may continue into the next, I'm sorry, yourself is a, you're a purely material being, according to atheism. So you're nothing more than your body. And as a result, your self ceases to exist once your body stops existing, ceases to exist. But Christianity argues, of course, for a dualistic sense of self. That, you know, in our view, under a Christian worldview, one of the benefits of having a Christian worldview is that you're more than a physical material being. You have a soul, and this soulishness about you, this soulish self, transcends your physical, mortal experience and carries your characteristics, your attributes, your traits, your memories, and everything into eternity. So this sense of the persistent self typically reduces the kind of fear that we experience as we approach death. Anyway, not that that should be the reason why you believe Christianity is true, but it definitely is a benefit of holding a Christian worldview. Okay, now that being the case, let's take Oliver calling from Rockland, Maine. How are you, Oliver? Thanks for being so patient.
Hey, Mr. Wallace, I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm so glad you called.
So my question here is on Ezekiel 38. I've heard multiple, you know, what people think this means. You know, this, some people think it's like talking about a war that's to come later in the future, and some, I've like Hank Hanegraaff specifically, I don't know if you know who he is.
Yep,
the Bible answer. So,
yep. Mm-hmm.
He seems to hold the view that it's something that's already happened. So I'm just trying to see, you know, what's the correct view, and that might.
I'm always afraid when I get a call like this, right? Because, you know, what's the correct view? I mean, there are some things I'll just tell you right now that are not specific enough to be able to land as, well, what's the correct view versus the, it's a matter sometimes of how we exegete a passage on the basis, and this is why you'll have different opinions. Now, Hank's a friend of mine. I love Hank, and he's been very good to me, and I consider him a friend. And Hank is somebody who, though you said, well, Hank has this view. Well, why do we say that? Because we know that there are apparently other people who hold different views. So what we have to do is hold some of these, especially prophecies. Now, let me just give you some basic principles that may frustrate you, Oliver, because I may not be able to land this for you, but I'm going to read the passage. Now, can you tell me which verses in Ezekiel 38 you're concerned with?
Just the whole, the passage as a whole. I don't have any specific verses. Just the fact that it seems to be talking about, you know, Gog and Magog, they're going to come up against Israel. Is that speaking of a certain nation? You know, obviously Gog and Magog don't exist anymore, but whatever nation it is that is in its place, I guess is what I'd say, you know, whatever, is that nation going to come up against Israel, or is it talking about literally Gog and Magog, and that already happened, and they have already come up against Israel sometime thousands of years ago?
Okay, so let me give you some principles that I usually use when I apply to this kind of thing, and Amy here at Stand to Reason knows this because I just wrote another book that comes out in September. It's called Person of Interest, where I have an entire chapter on prophecy. And the person I trust most when I write a new book to kind of vet it and tell me where I'm crazy is Amy Hall at Stand to Reason. So I sent her a copy first, and I knew, hey, if all I got was Amy to edit this, I'd be good. And so she was kind enough to spend forever editing it. And we went to sit on the phone like three or four times going back and forth. But let me tell you what my general principles are. Now, I would apply this as I think about whether a prophecy is describing as messianic or not, or if it's describing Jesus, because often you'll see that people will use certain prophecies and they will point to them and they will argue this describes the coming Messiah, when maybe the Jewish culture, the Jewish people who have held this scripture for years would say, well, no, that's not actually talking about the Messiah. This is talking about King David, or it's talking about whoever, okay? So the question then becomes, well, how do we know that a prophecy, a piece of scripture from the Old Testament is messianic, is really describing the coming Messiah? Here, what we're talking about is whether a passage of Old Testament scripture is describing end times or if it's describing something that already happened. Would you agree? So it's kind of the same situation where we're saying, hey, is it describing something that's going to happen in the future, or is it describing something that's already happened? Are we misreading this? Are we taking this application of this verse and applying it to the future when, in fact, all it was ever meant to do was describe something that was in the past? And that's always the trick, right? So here's how I describe it when it comes to messianic prophecies. Some evidences you find in a crime scene are incredibly clear. So I get to the crime scene and I find DNA. Well, DNA points to somebody. I can even identify sometimes somebody in advance of meeting him. Same is true with fingerprints. If I find a set of fingerprints at the crime scene, I run through the database and it describes John Smith, who lives in, you know, Southern California in San Diego, let's say. Well, I go find John Smith in San Diego and I actually know who I'm looking for before I go knock on his door because the evidence is clear. Now, there's other kinds of evidence in crime scenes that's cloaked. And here's what I mean by that. Let's say I find a button in the crime scene. And there's no button missing on the victim's shirt. So is this button missing from the suspect's shirt? Maybe. Certainly, though, the button is not going to tell me where to go beforehand. It's not like a fingerprint or it's not like DNA that is so clear that it can tell me who the suspect is before I ever meet him. This button is only going to tell me something after the fact. In other words, once I meet the suspect, if his shirt happens to be missing a button, I will know that that's actually evidence of his involvement in the crime, even though when I first found it, it was cloaked. Now, the reason why I make this distinction between clear and cloaked evidence related to the Messiah is because something happens. So, for example, we have some scriptures. If you just I constantly will see people using messianic prophecies, and I'm looking at them, and they're just lumping in all the clear with the cloaked. And I, as a skeptic, I'm like, no, this cloaked stuff, I mean, Jews don't consider that cloaked prophecy to be about the Messiah. Why are you considering it? Because some New Testament author said it was? Well, it could still be evidence, but you wouldn't know it was evidence until the suspect arrives and you examine his shirt. Then you go, wow, this seems to fit. And so now after the fact, after I meet him, now this is actually good evidence. I would not throw the button away. It could still be potential evidence, but it's not going to point me in advance. It's only going to confirm after the fact. So I look at this passage in Ezekiel, and so the question is this the kind of thing that will point in advance to something that's going to happen in the future, or is it the kind of thing that after the future event happens, we'll be able to look back at this and say, wow, that was prophetic? And that's where I'm not as certain as others. So I look now, one thing for sure, it's quite possible, and you see it all throughout the Old Testament where God, using his prophets, declares something that has both present application in the generation of the prophet and future application as well. It's not an either or, it's often a both and, okay? So it may very well be that this is describing a future event. But I will tell you, this is maybe, you might see this as a weakness in J. Warren Wallace, but I'm hesitant to make firm proclamations. At least this much. I'm hesitant to say, okay, this is a prophecy that I'm going to start watching the news every day, and I'm going to look and see if there are current events that I can fit into this future prophecy. And what I do see is a lot of us will take a prophecy like this, a passage like this in Ezekiel 38, and we'll say, wow, he is clearly describing something in the future, but maybe it isn't all that much future because I just read something in the news yesterday, and now we're starting to try to construct our interpretation of modern current events on the basis of whatever our favorite Old Testament passage is. And then we'll start to have meetings, and you can come to conferences where we talk about how world events demonstrate that there are end times. And one of the things I think will be helpful, and I don't know about you guys, but I listen to somebody, not because his name sounds familiar to mine, but because when I travel, I have a hard time falling asleep in hotels. So I listen to, not that he puts me to sleep, but I need to have the comfort of Scripture. So I want to hear Scripture when I'm falling asleep, and I want to hear it all night long, even when I wake up. So I let it play all night long, and here's what I listen to. I listen to J. Vernon McGee, who is a preacher from the early 70s here in Southern California. He was from Texas originally, so he's got a nice Southern drawl, and he preached all the way through Scripture from Genesis to Revelation. And it's available on as a podcast, so you can pop it on, and you can, if you had the time, you could listen. I don't know how long it would take. But I wake up in the first part of 1 Corinthians. I go to sleep at the first part of the 1 Corinthians. I wake up at the end of 1 Corinthians. He's been talking about 1 Corinthians all night because I let it roll. Now, here's what I've learned from J. Vernon McGee. It turns out that when he describes the world around him in 1970, you'd swear he's talking about 2021. Mm-hmm. It turns out that every generation of Bible preacher could find something in Scripture and point to some aspect of his current life and the current events in his life and declare that we are at the end of the world. So I'm always hesitant to do this because people have been doing it for generations and they've died and they are not, we're still not there yet. So they weren't right in 1940, they're not right in 1970, they're not right in 2021. So I have a tendency to be hesitant about applying this kind of thing to current events today. But, so now back to your question about Ezekiel 38. Well, how do I hold this? I am extremely open-handed about any of this. If you said, I think the conclusion is X, I would say, well, that's interesting. As your brother, I'm like, okay, tell me why you hold that. Great, let's make a case for that. Great, I find it interesting. But if you told me that, as my brother, you hold position Z, completely opposite, or position A, I'm going to say, that's interesting. I'm not going to divide from you because I may not agree with you on how you've interpreted this because I hold it with a very open hand. And I think in the end, these kinds of prophecies are just not specific. I'm reading through this prophecy right now. I don't think it's specific enough for me to lock into 2021 or the future beyond 2021. I don't know how this will play out in the future. I think that, and I've written an article about end times, and so it's on our website. I hate to always be pointing back to our website to get you to this information, but let me just put it in here right now so we can, I can show it to you here, or at least talk to you about it. And if you just type in end times on the Cold Case Christianity website, the article is, what does the Bible say about end times? Three historic perspectives. And actually, in this article, you'll see how I feel about these kinds of passages. But just be prepared. This is a survey of end time approaches. And I don't land any of these for people because I'm not going, I hold all three of them pretty much evenly. And by the way, and if you take that position where you are not, you don't want to land your end time philosophy, or for example, you don't want to land where you feel about the age of the earth in Genesis 1 or any of these controversial issues, you do not ingratiate yourself to either side. You just make every side mad at you, right? Because you won't land on one of these three perspectives. But I don't land on any of these three perspectives. I think when we get there, we'll find out the truth. And it's like cloaked evidence. We'll best know about how to interpret Ezekiel 38 after the fact.
You know, I definitely think that's a safe way to go about it. You know, we'll find out one day. We know Jesus will come back. So
yeah,
till then.
Yeah, yeah. It's always this analogy. When we work at a homicide, unless the guy confesses, and they do sometimes. Sometimes they'll confess after the case is adjudicated. They'll confess sometimes right before trial because they're trying to get a plea bargain. But before they confess, like all of our partners, five guys and a sergeant, we're trying to figure out, like, how do you think he did this? Like, I wish he would confess so I would know how he did it. I had a case, for example, where, you know, I wasn't sure, did he attack her downstairs or upstairs? Because there's blood on the hallway, the stairwell, scraped against the wall. Is that because he killed her downstairs and carried her upstairs? Is that because he killed her upstairs and just maybe brushed his hand against the wall? Like, I wanted to know, where did he do it? How did he do it? Why did he do it? He would never confess to it. I had a theory. My five partners all had five different theories. And we would kind of like argue about this between each other, right? Well, it turns out that eventually this guy confessed to it, and we were all wrong. Because none of us think like the bad guy. You know, we'd like to think we do, but, you know, the bad guys think like bad guys, and good guys don't. I mean, unless you have this kind of mindset for what you're doing that day, it's hard to get in that person's head. So in the end, we pretty much are ready to be wrong. And I think the same thing is going to happen here. I've got questions about some of these issues in Scripture. And when I get in front of God, I'm going to ask him. And I guarantee you, all of us are going to be slightly wrong. Because the gap between the bad guy who I'm taking to jail for a murder and me is much smaller than the gap between me and God. Okay? You think you don't understand how bad guys think. You have no idea how God's thinking on this. So in the end, I am prepared to be corrected about any view I may hold, if that makes sense. So... Anyway, I hope that helps a little bit, Oliver, as you kind of think through those issues, okay?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah, for sure. Appreciate it. We're going to just answer questions right through the break here, if you don't mind, and we'll talk to Darren in Pennsylvania. How are you doing, Darren? Good to talk to you.
Hey, Ed. Great to talk to you.
Yeah.
Just wanted to convey a little encouragement to you before I get to the question.
Okay.
About 2 years ago, I started a apologetics group in my church. And I called in and talked to Greg, and he gave me some advice. We went through his first tactics book, and then we did your Cold Case Christianity book. And then COVID hit, but one of my students couldn't just sit around, so she started her own group among another church. So we're kind of spreading out with some of your message. So I really appreciate all you do.
Well, and that's so awesome to hear. Yeah, you know what's interesting about that too, Darren, is that you had passion. And passion is contagious. And what's interesting is sometimes people will say to me, like, you know, I'm teaching students, and they seem to be kind of apathetic. Like they lack passion. And, you know, there's ways we can increase passion, you know, by answering the right kinds of questions will help you with increasing passion in your group. But I always say, well, you know, a lot of times passion is just not the kind of thing you can teach. You have to model it. And you did that, right? So then somebody catches your passion and they're like, you know, I do need Darren, but I mean, if this is not available, I'll do it without him, right? Because they're passionate. So I think that's really cool that you were able to transfer your passion. But go ahead with your question.
Well, my question is directly related. I want to do even more. I want to get engaged with especially non-believers and have these conversations. How can I be more effective in putting myself into some kind of circumstance to do that?
Yeah, boy, I tell you, a lot of it is being sensitive to your environment, right? Because I can give you an example of this. When I was not a believer, I was not sensitive to God's interaction in the world around me at all. So if he was working around me, I would have just written it off to coincidence, to happenstance, to some kind of natural cause, to some force of you know, cause and effect. I would have never have attributed or credited God with anything that was happening. And why was that? Because I didn't have God-sensitive eyes. In other words, I wasn't looking at the world and the actions in the world and considering God as a potential candidate because I didn't have God-sensitive eyes. And once I became a Christian, I realized, wow, a lot of this I've been walking right by. It turns out I probably shouldn't have been walking right by that stuff. I probably should have been paying more attention to it. What I think happens here is, so what I'm looking for now is that you are now in a position where you need to have opportunity-sensitive eyes, right? Where you are in a place where you actually see, when you meet somebody, you have a better sense immediately of whether there's an opportunity or not. Like you're looking for opportunities. And I think you already probably are doing that. But then the question becomes, well, like what are the ways that we communicate with each other? I can't tell you. It's not like you probably need me to tell you how to get into more connection with others. You probably already have these connections. The problem is that you and I, we don't want to take advantage of the connections we already have, right? So, for example, I'm going to tomorrow be in face-to-face contact with a number of people, just in my daily life. If I'm going to the store, if I'm going, whatever I'm doing, I'm going to be in contact with people. But I'm probably not going to engage every one of those in a spiritual conversation. But that's a choice. So it's not so much that it's about, well, how do I get in front of more people? You're already in front of enough people. The question is, how do I take those first steps with every person I'm already in front of? And that's really what it comes down to, right? It's us being courageous. I always tell people when you're on a SWAT team, the scariest part of any entry is breaching the doorway. And right. We have lots of techniques for this. How do we get through the open door into the room, into the unknown? The door's closed. We don't know what hides behind the door. We don't know what's awaiting for us behind the door. Breaching the door is the most significant thing we will do. And if we're not careful, that's the one thing that will lead to our demise. Is breaching the door. Now, once we get in the doorway, things are a lot easier because we can see what's going on there and we're more in control. But breaching the door is tricky and it's scary and it can make you think twice before you're like, do I really want to do this? Well, the same thing is true with spiritual conversations. It's about breaching the doorway. Like that first step through the door is the scariest. And it feels dangerous sometimes because you're not quite sure what that person's thinking or what that person's attitude is. And you're probably thinking to yourself, you know what? I'm not sure I want to go through this door. But that's number one. Can you take advantage of every potential doorway? And there's lots of doors that you're going to face tomorrow. And you're only going to walk through a couple of them because you don't think the time is right. Or you're not quite sure what to say. Remember, you've probably heard me talk about the two things in forensic faith that I talked about. You know, what do you think happens when you die? That's a great first opening question. And I noticed you're wearing that watch, and it appears to be designed for a purpose. And what were you designed for? Like, what is your purpose? great opening question, because it gets right into purpose, which people actually, that's a good gateway conversation, because people, they might not care about God, but they care about their purpose. But if you think about it, your purpose is always connected. The purpose of any designed object is dependent on what the designer intended that thing to do. So any discussion about purpose ultimately will probably lead back to, well, who designed you? So there's a couple of ways to initiate those conversations. You probably already heard that. But then the question becomes, I think, Darren, like, what are the avenues, right? Like, I mean, you have personal conversations. I write articles. Why do you write art? I mean, I've been writing articles. I wrote articles for probably 7 or 8 years before anybody knew I was writing articles. It just became from the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. And I just didn't feel like I could learn this stuff and not want to proclaim it somehow. So back when, you know, I think I started the blog in, I don't know, 2000 maybe, 2001, and just maybe before that, and just really wanted to like proclaim what I had learned. And so we started this blog that nobody was reading at pleaseconvinceme.com. And it was just, you know, a way of us kind of, this is what I would suggest for you. Look, you may feel like, I'd love to talk to somebody today, but I don't have a chance. But you have something on your mind, something on your heart, write it out. You know, it's really easy to blog these days. If nothing else, post it on your social media. I mean, there's ways to communicate with people, even when you feel like today may not be the day that I get into a 2-hour conversation with somebody. And really, almost anyone can create a YouTube video. Doesn't take much. Your webcam on your laptop is sufficient these days to do YouTube videos. There are so many ways to contribute as a $1 apologist. That you may not be, and again, you know, and it's organic. Like when I first started doing this, I wasn't concerned about how many people were reading me. I just needed to get this off my chest. So I wrote it, or I podcasted. I remember I used to podcast on my phone driving to work. Now, how crummy does that sound? But when I got home, I would just put a bumper on each end and I would call it a podcast. Well, what are you doing? I wanted to talk about these things. And sometimes I didn't have somebody I was going to talk to that day I couldn't scratch that itch. So you have the itch. Now the question is, how do you scratch it? So.
Right.
Hope that's helpful. Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, I'm going to strive to do a little more of those things, to get some things down on paper and practice my writing and, I'm set up to do some videos, so I'll try that. But you know, just being stepping through the door with the conversations I have, I'm going to try to be more intentional about that, and just to be the most effective I can be.
Well, let me tell you, don't underestimate what you've already done. The fact that you started a group at your church is huge, because you already have an audience that you might think, well, they already know that Christianity is true. Really? A lot of people who are deconstructing their faith are people who really never understood what their faith was about to begin with. So when we're doing this work, you might think, well, I want to reach non-believers. Well, how about reaching the people who, if you don't reach them, well, in the future will become non-believers? That's a worthwhile adventure, okay? And so a lot of what you're doing is you're doing the work that God has given you. And when Greg talks about just blooming where you're planted, that is not just a catchphrase that Greg is trying to leverage for marketing, okay? That's actually the way that it works. And anytime you try to do something more than that, you start to be so prideful in how you're marketing yourself. But the people who just say, you know what, I'm not interested in becoming something, I'm just interested in doing this work where I am, can protect themselves from the dangers of celebrity, can protect themselves from the dangers of pride. And so there's a sense in which bloom where you're planted is a very biblical way to engage the world around you without becoming a jerk. You know what I mean? Without becoming so prideful that you're now a liability to the church rather than an asset. So I think, just want to congratulate you for doing what you're doing. That start is start enough, to be honest. So get after it.
Well, I thank you for everything that you do, and for Greg, going through the tactics in the cold case has really helped not only myself, but as I said, the others that were in the group, and now it's even expanding, and I just keep trying to ask questions of people.
That's it. That's all it is. Take advantage of opportunities you already have. I appreciate you, Darren. Thanks so much for calling us. Let's do one more before we break for the day. Susan in Los Angeles. How are you, Susan? Good to talk to you. What can I do for you today? Are you there, Susan? I know she's there. I'm not going to give up on her. Susan, you called from Los Angeles. Hey, how are you, Susan? Good to talk to you. Yeah, I can hear you now. No problem.
Great. So my question is about masks. I'm not vaccinated because I'm just really super particular about what I put in my body. Yep. And as you know, probably know, as of today in California, you don't have to wear a mask inside if you're vaccinated. And I don't want to wear a mask. I understand the risk for myself, and I know that I'm not a threat to vaccinated people. So I was thinking of where it says in Romans to be subject to governing authorities, and I'm wondering, as a Christian, if I need to wear a mask inside.
Okay, so this is, you had to call with this hot button issue right before I got, I almost had a clean getaway here. And no, you had to mess it up by calling with this question. No, this is good. I mean, okay, so let me just tell you where I'm coming from and you can judge me accordingly, okay? So I kind of feel like, you know, it's not so much that I fly a lot. And I'm in planes or in airports, and you know you're going to be stuck under federal guidelines probably for a lot longer than any state is going to require a mask. I'm going to be stuck wearing a mask in airplanes and in airports forever probably, right? So it's no fun when you're traveling all day and you're stuck in a mask all day when you really think to yourself, why am I wearing this mask? Now, I'll tell you, from my perspective, I have a slightly different perspective. Our agency at the police department where I've worked for years and I now serve as a chaplain, my son's there also. Everyone got vaccinated back in January. And you know, as first responders, I've been vaccinated for my flu shot every year for 30 years. I've never had the flu in 30 years. And so I was not as opposed to the vaccination as maybe others are. And I totally respect those who hold a different position than I do. But as part of that first responder team, when they said, okay, here's your date for a vaccination, I just fell online and I wasn't going to be allowed to be in the agency, to be able to be on call outs, to be all that stuff unless I was vaccinated. So I got vaccinated. And I'll tell you that it's even more. You think it's frustrating to be masked now. It's even more frustrating to be masked because there's a regulation in place when you know you've been vaccinated. So, but why do I do it? Well, okay. So part of this is trying to honor the weaker brother, right? So when there are people who are more freaked out about this, then I am willing to wear the mask, even though I don't see a necessity for it. I am willing to wear the mask for the comfort of others. And here's why. I never know. Well, okay, so let me give it to you a weird way. Last year, every year in the summer, Susie and I, we volunteer with Operation Heal Our Patriots, which is a marriage retreat for wounded veterans. And I spend time in Alaska with these veterans. And this year, for example, we're doing it for 2 weeks with officers who have been shot in the line of duty. Now, last year when we went, we all were issued masks by Operation Heal Our Patriots, Samaritan's Purse. And it had the Samaritan's Purse cross logo on the front of the mask. I've been wearing that for a year. It's the most comfortable mask I have. And I just happen to wear it. Here's the problem with it. Every time I wear it, the stupid cross is on the front of it, and everyone knows I'm a Christian. So when I'm getting irritated with people, they're like, look at this Christian getting irritated, right? It's like, it. If you have to wear this thing engraved on your face that says, I'm the Christian who should not be acting this way, when you're frustrated, it becomes like the thing that keeps you in line. I kind of think in some way, as a Christian who wants to reach non-Christians, if there's somebody out there who is hung up over whether I'm wearing a mask and it prevents me from being able to preach the gospel to him at some point in this conversation or to at least leave an impression with him. And I'm wearing the mask. It's got a cross on it. So no matter what I do, I'm going to leave an impression about Christianity on that person. But it turns out that even if you don't have a cross on your mask, the potential is there to either leave an impression for good or an impression for bad based on what you're willing to do with the stupid mask. So even though I'm vaccinated, I'm actually wearing the mask at times because I want the person I'm talking to, who may not understand what I understand about this or may not even hold my view on this, but I'm trying to reach them for the gospel. So I'm taking that step that I don't think is necessary because I don't want to offend the other. Now, I can tell you there's been lots of places where I've been amongst my Christian brothers and I knew I would offend them if I did wear a mask, okay? So I'm always trying to figure it out. That's why being vaccinated kind of changes things for me because I don't feel like I'm at the same level of risk. Now, I could be wrong about that, but that's just my impression of it. Now, I'm not sure that's going to help you to kind of navigate this, but a lot of times what I'm trying to say, the bigger principle for me is I'm trying to say, is what I'm about to do or not do going to impact the way my ability to share the gospel? And so what I do is make a decision about whether I wear the mask or not wear the mask, whether I behave this way or not behave this way, based on whether I think it leaves the door open for the gospel. And that's been really the kind of the guiding principle that has made the decisions for me. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Now,
feel free to push back on me on that, because I want to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, I think what I'm talking about are going into Trader Joe's or something where I'm probably not going to have a conversation with anybody. So I don't know that my witness is affected, but I do know that I don't want to cause anyone fear or anxiety. And maybe I know the answer to my question, and I just feel a little, I'm starting to feel pressure from the government, and that is actually now making me less want to get the vaccine. And so I know that I need to pray about that and submit that to God, because I don't want to be rebellious.
Okay, then that's a great point, because here we are in California, right? And now I'm seeing, for example, they're offering like contests. If you get the vaccination, you get to be thrown into the contest, and you can win a trip to here or there. At some point, we're like, really? Yeah. And I find myself doing what you're doing. Now, I've already been vaccinated, but I'm thinking to myself, maybe I wish I hadn't gotten vaccinated, because I don't want to be pressured into it. But that really is not a statement about whether it's good, right, wrong, effective, ineffective. That's really a statement about me just being so prideful that I don't want to be told what to do, right? So I'm,
yes,
like you. I'm trying to make sure.
Concern.
Yes, and that's what I'm trying to make sure too. That if in the end, I know lots of people who hold a reasoned position on either side of this. They hold a reasoned position. And I want to make sure that I hold a reasoned position as well. And I'm not just reacting because I feel like, well, no one's going to tell me that I have to do this or not do this. But I will tell you this, that once I was vaccinated, and I tell people this all the time, I didn't think much of it at the time. I just thought, okay, all of us who are in this agency, we're all getting vaccinated in the same week. I'm part of this agency. I'm going to get it. Now, I'm sure there was a way to opt out. I just didn't think of it that way. I just thought, well, no, I want to be able to be still valuable as a chaplain if they call me. I want to be able to go in the station. I want to be able to have no limitations on this kind of a thing. Now, in the end, okay, so I did it. Once I did it, I felt like the pandemic was somebody else's pandemic, only because it felt like the precautionary struggles didn't apply to me anymore. I've been vaccinated, so why am I wearing? I always say this: if you're going to have me wear the mask afterwards and have to socially distance, if all the regulations are going to be the same after getting vaccinated, why'd I get vaccinated? The whole reason I got vaccinated was to try to get rid of these restrictions. So a lot of that is, I think, part of our thinking too, is that we're not really thinking of it in terms of, well, are we thinking about it in terms of the virus and the transmission of the virus, or am I thinking about it really in terms of what it imposes on my life, and I'm tired of that, so I want to get rid of those restrictions. So again, a lot of this does come back down to, I want to be the boss of my own life. And I get it. I am the boss. I mean, I think there's some part of that which is totally reasonable. And so the only reason why today I either do or don't wear a mask, I talk about it or don't talk about it, is for the comfort level of the people. And I'm like you. I go to Trader Joe's too. And I'm thinking, you know what? When I go to Trader Joe's, I just might meet somebody I could share the gospel with. Am I going to preclude myself before I even start? And because I don't want to be that kind of person who doesn't even give myself a chance to share the gospel because they already hate me for doing this or not doing this, that's the struggle I have right now. And that's why I'm trying to figure out. And maybe it's a good thing that the cross of Christ has been stuck on the front of my face mask, because it's caused me to think about when you're gracious towards somebody, and no one's probably going to get mad at you for wearing the mask in front of them as much as they're probably going to get mad at you for not wearing the mask in front of them, especially here in California. And those are the very people I'm trying to reach. So I'm going to do whatever I have to do to be able to reach them. Does that make sense?
It is. It's helpful. I think it's my motivation and my attitude that I need to check.
Well, nobody needs to check it more than I do. Okay, so I totally get where you're coming from, all right? I got so impatient within the first month of being vaccinated, this that you know, depending on where I would travel, And just the fact that in travel, don't you love it that they'll tell you to remain distanced by 6 feet as you're going down the jetway, so you can get in a large tube where you'll be sitting at millimeters from the person next to you. Really? So I'm going to distance before I get in the tube, but in the tube, we're going to be like sardines. At some point, I'm thinking to myself, this makes no sense. At the same time, the person I'm sitting next to, I am likely to get into a conversation with. And so, therefore, I have to be really careful. I feel like, if I got a little glass of water in front of me, I can pull this mask down for the next 20 minutes, right? No, actually, I'm going to have to be more restrictive than that, because I don't know where this person sits, where they stand on this issue. So I need to make sure that I'm at least representing a view that allows me the open door, right? Because it's quite likely that if I make the wrong step, I'll lose the opportunity altogether. So that's why, for me, that is the guiding principle right now. In this period of time in which we are waiting for all the restrictions to be lifted, it's still my guiding principle that I don't care what the restrictions are. This is not about restrictions. This is about trying to reach people with the gospel. So there I am, stuck with it. Right? So I hope that helps you a little bit.
Thanks,
Susan. I appreciate you calling me so much.
It is.
Yeah, I appreciate you calling.
Helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, we're screaming up on the end of the hour here, and I appreciate everyone who has called in. This is a week where we get a chance as we approach summer. This is the time when we're going to be in front of a lot of people. Some of the restrictions are coming off here in our state, so this is the time when we're going to be actually out in community, maybe a little more. I've noticed now that, for example, on Memorial Day, I thought that some of the places that usually were packed were still kind of half packed because people weren't quite sure whether or not we should be like hanging out this deeply. But now that the restrictions are off in a lot of states, I think you're going to get a chance to be face to face with people in your community. And I hope as that happens that you will start to think about what it is you are going to say to them and what it is that your priorities are, and take that risk of breaching the breaching the barricade, breaching the door, of actually jumping. I call this jumping the evangelism wall. The biggest thing, the most difficult step in evangelism, is the first 30 seconds. And I know what you're thinking. I don't share it because it feels awkward. Doesn't feel okay. I get it. Get over awkward. Awkward's going to be the first 30 seconds. And after that 30 seconds, you'll be in a deeper conversation than you probably expected. So just remember that it's the first 30 seconds that are difficult. And after that, you're going to get really comfortable quickly. So all you have to do is be uncomfortable for a few seconds. Take advantage of that this summer as you're talking to people and breach that door. Get through the first few seconds of a conversation, and then you'll see that you'll make a difference for the kingdom. Thanks so much for listening to us this week at Stand to Reason. I'm Jay Warner Wallace sitting in for Greg Kokel. See you back here next week at Stand to Reason.